Hello, and welcome back to Novel Gaming, a podcast about books and video games with foretellings of other pop culture. Ooh. I'm Doug.
I'm Katie.
And today, it's a book club episode, and we threw it back quite a bit. Maybe the furthest back we've thrown it? I'm not really sure.
At least for the podcast, maybe?
Yeah, I think that's true, because we read Ursula K. Le Guin's 1969 novel, The Left Hand of Darkness. Before we get honestly pretty deep and philosophical, let's spend some time keeping it light with some stuff we've been playing, watching, and pondering. So, Katie, what have you been playing?
Oh, Doug, I did a thing, and I'm so glad I did a thing. I am playing Baldur's Gate 3.
Whoa!
Yes. A game that is extremely my jam.
Whoa.
We've got story. We've got character creator is extensive in some ways, but not in physical appearance, really. They've got like a couple set options for each species of character.
Gotcha.
But like you can't, there's no sliders. So like the face, there's like a couple set faces for each. So it's interesting because I did spend a lot of time in it, but it wasn't as customizable as I expected it to be because of it's an RPG game. So I was like, it's going to be like some Mass Effect shit, some Slider shit, some Skyrim shit. And it was not like that.
So it's not the appearance stuff that you spent a ton of time on. It's like all the details and like attributes that you spent a bunch of time on.
Yeah, reading about what the things mean.
Oh, shit.
like, what is barbarian? What is the difference between barbarian and fighter? What is difference between warlock and wizard? Or cleric or bard?
Oh, so you were doing, like, full crash course in, like, D&D.
Yeah. I learned a lot. I still have a lot more to learn.
This is amazing. I'm so excited.
It's so fun. I have put so many hours into this game. And I know a lot of people are loving this game, so it's not like a revolutionary thing. But like, I've stayed up late playing this game on work nights.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Which I like haven't done. Honestly, I can't remember the last time I've stayed up late on work nights playing one game after I've already been playing it for like 4 hours. All I want to do is play this game.
Oh, that makes me so happy.
It makes me happy too. And I just love, there's like such depth and like so many different choices. And it's like, it's so good.
Okay.
If you ever play it, and then you want to play through it with somebody, I would love to play through this game with you. Because I hear the multiplayer's fun.
Yeah, I'm going to say exactly what you said to me when I said I was playing Elden Ring. I have so many questions. First, easy one. What are you playing it on?
I'm playing it on PlayStation 5.
How is that?
I'm enjoying it. It kind of plays like a third-person game.
Okay.
So I've never played CRPGs, which I found out stands just for computer RPGs, which is what that is.
I've never heard that before. I'm so ignorant to this.
Well, it's probably because I listen to so many video game podcasts. But if you play it on your PlayStation, like instead of clicking an area and having your character walk over there, you just control the character.
Sure.
Like a third person game. Okay. So it feels very kind of natural. And they have kind of some shortcuts for like choosing your attack or choosing an item or things like that.
So the controller feels okay, despite there being probably so much on the screen.
There's actually not as much as you would think at all times. Okay. At least for me right now. Like I've seen screenshots of people playing it on PC and it looks like there's a lot more visually like UI, user interface type stuff on PC things than on PlayStation 5. Okay. Which is fine by me. I don't know what I'm missing.
I was going to say, so it's cleaner on PS5 is what I'm hearing.
or I'm missing something and then I'm fine with it.
Yeah.
So.
Amazing. Okay, second question.
Yes.
What race, class, like tell me what you remember about this character. Yeah. Because I know goes real deep.
I'm a drow.
Nice.
Which is like an underdark dwelling elf person kind of, and people are kind of mean to drows. And I am playing, I Googled what's like the easiest class to start with.
Sure.
And a lot of people said fighter. So I'm a fighter.
Dang.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, this is so cool.
There's a lot of mechanics in the game. Like, there's a lot of mechanics, I'm assuming, in D&D play. Mm-hmm. So it's fun to, like, I don't know, start to learn some of that stuff. Like, there are things I've seen in, like, Dimension 20. Like, Tasha's Hideous Laughter is, like, a fucking move in this game.
Yeah!
Yeah, so it's, like, really cool to see those things in a video game instead of just, like, on a screen, you know?
Oh,
like, that I'm watching people play.
This is so exciting because, like, my I kind of was like, I'm not going to play Baldur's Gate because I don't have a computer that can handle it, and I don't know that I'm going to know anyone playing it on PlayStation. But now...
Well, you do, Doug.
But now
you
I do.
You do indeed. Yeah. And I
wow.
would...
So much to consider now.
Love. Yeah, I would love to play it with you for a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
It's also a pretty horny game, which I always enjoy.
Oh, I've heard.
So...
I've heard they had to turn the horny down. Like, they accidentally
did,
made it, like, too horny.
I'm sad I didn't play it when it was too horny. Can we turn
I'm
that back
too.
Up, please?
I'm sad for you.
Yeah.
They should have just made it optional. They should have been like, all right, we're going to patch it, but, like, take your pick.
That's the thing in, like, dating sims. They're like, all right, what do you want here? You want sex? You want romance? You want friendship?
Right.
What do you want? We'll go to your level. Let me do that in RPGs, and let me turn sex all the way up and romance all the way
that's
up.
That's the slider we really need.
Yeah, for real.
Oh my god, that's incredible. Oh, that's so cool. I'm so happy.
Yeah, me too. And the story is obviously really fun and engaging too, and there's so many things happening, so you can choose your own adventure.
Hell yeah.
Which is cool. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, you still playing Elden Ring? You playing anything else?
Yeah, well, I am still playing Elden Ring, but I needed something that was, like, very opposite to that, something that I could, like, cleanse and, like, chill to. And so I finally started playing, and this is something I think both you and Vicky recommended to me a long time ago, but I finally started playing Unpacking, which is very chill and very relaxing and very opposite to Elden Ring. and it is very sweet. I like it a lot. You were both correct. I am enjoying it quite a bit.
I want to talk to you about it, but I also don't want to... how far along are you?
Sure. So I will put the minor spoiler warning on here if you don't want any sort of spoileriness around Unpacking, because there is kind of a story that gets portrayed along the way. Then jump ahead a little bit. The last full... room that I did or full home that I did seemed to be either a long-term relationship or a marriage of some sort. It is the apartment that is very sleek and full of, like, black and silver, stuff like that. And then I finished that home and was like, all right, I finished. I usually do one at a time. I'm, like, letting it breathe, you know? I finished that one and did see that the next home is my childhood room, and I don't know why yet. I don't know why I'm there, and I was like, I promised myself that I was gonna end after I finished this home, so I don't know. I still don't know, but I'm very excited to find out, and a little bit
I'm
worried
so
to be honest, because there's so many reasons why I could be there.
Yeah, what happened?
Yeah,
I'm very excited then for you to continue playing and to maybe make some guesses and find out some more things.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if we're in the spoiler zone, like, the first things that came to mind was, like, if I'm married, did we get divorced? Am I actually divorced, or am I, like, moving home to take care of a parent? Was I never married to begin with, and this relationship just didn't work out? I moved a lot of their stuff. Did they get pissed about that? Like, there's so many possibilities, you know? So we'll see what it is. Or I guess I'll see.
You'll see, and we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
I want to talk about that game so much. I don't know if Vicky and I talked a lot about it. Vicky, for those who are in the unaware stage, is our co-founder and former co-host, still occasional co-host.
We always have to set that up, especially on book club episodes, because the book club episodes are certainly more often people's first episodes. So
yeah,
I forget to set that stage.
Yeah,
but yeah, I don't even know if she knows I'm playing it. So that'll be fun for her to learn.
Yes.
But yeah, wow, wildly different games.
Yeah.
What are you watching?
Yeah, so because I've been playing so much Baldur's Gate, I haven't been watching a ton. And honestly, because I've also been, especially this past week, fitting in our book club book whenever I'm not playing Baldur's Gate.
Well, it's such a light read, though.
Yeah, you just breeze through it, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Easy breezy. I have watched, honestly, just like a little bit of Dropout stuff here and there. Some nice. Some Make Some Noise. And I watched right before this the Dirty Laundry with the four wonderful
shit.
Drag queens.
That
on
dropped
there. Yeah.
Today as we record this, I think, right? Or did it drop yesterday, maybe?
It might have been yesterday. Either way, it's still pretty fresh. It's very good, and I'm very excited for you to watch it, too.
I'm so excited for that one, because Dirty Laundry is already a lot of fun. And these are people I've known so much longer than I've known the Dropout people. Mm-hmm. And it's just like a totally different vibe, because it's not like the regular Dropout cast. It is like Drag Race cast. I finally watched, or started watching, I haven't finished it yet. I finally started watching the Make Some Noise that was like the karaoke, like the recent karaoke one with Wayne Brady. The karaoke ones, mind-blowing. I just don't understand. Like, how is that possible? Especially when any of them do rap. Like,
right, because it's so fast. Yes. You have to think of so many words.
Yes, and I know that freestyle rapping, like competitive freestyle rapping, is a thing. Trust me, I know. But like, that doesn't make it any less amazing every single time I see it.
Super impressive. Right. If I'm going to be improvising songs, you're going to believe it's a ballad with like one chorus that gets repeated 10 times and maybe like one verse.
I'm holding on a note so I can think of what I'm saying next.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Dropout's good. We've said it a lot of times, but it's good.
It really is. So yeah, I've been watching some Dropout stuff. How about you? What have you been watching?
Yeah, a couple things. One, I recently watched the 1954 Godzilla movie because new Glitter Jaw show Skryonk is dropping.
Hey, Skryonk.
That's where Derek and I are watching every Godzilla movie ever, which is going to be like a 3-year long journey, I think, based on how many Godzilla movies there are.
Really? So
it's officially beginning. I think the intro episode's probably out when this episode of ours drops. So I recently watched the 54 Godzilla movie. It is very good. You can get our thoughts over there, but it is really good.
Nice.
And I didn't remember very much from it, so it was a fun watch. But I also watched a movie that I think is new, like this year, this season, No One Will Save You, which I think is a Hulu exclusive. It's a scary movie. It's like a sci-fi horror, and there's just a couple really wild things about it, some of which I can't say because it would ruin things about the movie. But one thing that I will definitely say, which is that no one talks, like no one says anything throughout the whole movie. It's unbelievable, because it's like it's a full length, like 90 minute movie,
right?
And there's just like no spoken script. It's incredible.
That's wild, because even what was that movie? I definitely watched this one where it was like a kind of creature film where they had to be quiet, otherwise they'd get murdered.
A Quiet Place, maybe?
Yeah, it could be. I think so. That sounds right, with like Emily Blunt.
There were a couple, I feel like, that came out around the same time.
Yeah. I keep thinking of Bird Box, but I think that's the one where you can't see, not that you can't speak. But there was still there was some talking in that movie.
Yeah, this one has like maybe 7 words total. Like, there's just no talking. And I didn't, like, pick up on it until maybe, like, 20 minutes in. And I was like,
shit,
no one said anything. Like, it's good. Like, there's still plenty of, like, communication happening.
Right.
Despite no one ever speaking. So.
Is it, I don't know if you can answer this, because I don't know if it would reveal anything. But is it related to, like, the plot, like, in A Quiet Place? is the not talking important for survival or something?
No, that's the thing that's so wild shit. About it. Like, it's just an artistic choice.
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah. So, like, I think maybe that's part of why I wasn't necessarily picking up on it right away, because it just was, like, there, and it wasn't, like, right. It's not pointed out in universe by anybody.
Right.
It just, like, is part of the movie as they were making it. It's just, I don't know. I haven't, like, looked up why they chose to do it. Maybe because part of me is like, I don't really care. Like, it was cool.
Yeah.
I don't like need like a fancy explanation. I just think it was neat
Why
that
not?
They did it. But it's a wild movie, and it has like some pretty wild twists and turns. I'm afraid to say too much, because like I feel
so
like
intrigued.
It's one of those movies that like you should go in knowing as little as possible, because I knew almost
How
nothing.
How scary is it?
Well, I guess I could say this based on the trailer. Like, if you, I won't say more than what the trailer will show you, which is like,
okay.
If alien stuff scares you,
relevant, yeah,
then maybe it's scary for you.
Okay.
But if alien stuff is cool, maybe you'll be jazzed about it and a little bit scared.
Yeah, just a little.
Yeah. So.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, I've been trying to, I'm behind for sure, given that we're like almost 2 weeks into the month already, but I've been trying to watch some scary movies and horror movies in October, and that's
Makes
one
sense.
Of the ones that I managed to get to.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds fun. I'm intrigued, so maybe I'll watch it during the day.
Well, is there anything you have been pondering or thinking about lately?
Honestly, just this book and...
Yeah.
After we record, I think I'm gonna do a major deep dive on the internet and like in other podcasts and stuff to see what do people say about this book. So
as a reminder, we're talking about The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin, who is a sci-fi legend, and this book is quite legendary, you know?
Yes.
It's a book from 1969, and I feel like the way that they wrote sci-fi was very different then.
Yes.
And before we even get into anything, I'm just going to say, first time for both of us. So I know that this book has been like analyzed academically for decades now. So what this is two people experiencing it for the first time.
Who, at least on my end, know nothing about the academic conversations, the pop culture conversations, quite honestly, any conversation about this book, because it was written in 1969, and I don't know how often it gets talked about today.
So if this feels novel to you, then that's perfect for you. If you're like, this is my favorite book and I've read everything about it, hopefully this is fun for you.
Yeah.
And you won't yell. You'll yell to your apartment and not directly at us.
Right. And yell
we're
like,
we're
going to
be processing and figuring it out together.
Yes. Now,
oh,
Doug,
boy.
I'm so interested.
Yes.
I mean, we've read previously, before we started this podcast, we did read an Ursula Le Guin book.
Yes.
What had you choose this one for us to read?
Yeah, there's a couple things. One, I was just like looking at our list of books that we had read, and I was trying to see like, is there something we haven't done in a while that we have kind of done before? And I noticed that like when Vicky was still picking books, she trended more towards being like the sci-fi classics or, you know, older books versus like contemporary books. So that was part of it. And that's sort of why I was like, you know, I kind of want to pick like an older book. I want to try to do like a Vicky pick, you know? I do think this is a very Vicky pick.
A very Vicky pick, yes.
Vicky's picks tended to be, not all the time, but tended to be weightier or more classic, right?
Yes.
So this or both. So this definitely fits that. I also wanted something, since I knew I was going to be digging backwards, I did want something that explored some sort of queer or queer related topic. Obviously, how that conversation was happening in 1969 is different than how it's happening in 2023 or 2020, sort of, which is where most of our queer stuff ends up being, is like within the past 5 years. But I really wanted to find something that was old but still fit kind of conversations that we had. And this was one that came up, and then seeing that it was one that was considered sort of a legendary book by a legendary author, I was like, you know what? Mm-hmm. What more in the spirit of a Vicky pick than picking like a behemoth of a text,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I hope she will be proud that I chose this one.
Yeah. I wonder if she's read this before. We should have checked in.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
We might have known too much if she had, you know?
That's true.
This might be tough, but any sort of one sentence description or distilled down description?
Yeah, I think I would describe it as a philosophical book about the experience of, it's difficult because they're called all kind of humans.
Yeah.
Like a human alien on another planet that explores ideas of gender, sexuality, and nation. I think that's what I would say. How about you?
I would say this is the story of an earthling from about maybe 1,000 years into our future who tries to convince a planet to join a confederation of planets and is really thrown off when he encounters gender queerness and does not know what to do with that. That's how I would describe this book.
Yeah. Yeah. It, yes. I think we'll have a lot to talk about in terms of that. One thing that I do think is important to like note as kind of like a content warning type of thing.
Yeah.
There is a surprising amount of like suicide talk within the book that I was not expecting based on, I thought it was about like, you know, gender, what happens with someone who's experiencing folks who don't conform to their idea of gender. And mm-hmm. then there was like multiple mentions of like suicide in the book.
Yeah.
Nothing too graphic or deep or anything like that, but it just pops up a lot.
I think there are a few things like that where there's never graphic descriptions of the few things I'm going to mention, but they are mentioned very casually and sort of like part of regular conversation in a way that I think may or may not be tackled in like a different language now,
mm-hmm.
Or with a different hand now. So things like suicide, things like rape, and things like mm-hmm. Certain mental health conversations are tackled in a way that would absolutely be tackled differently. And what's interesting about some of them is that the ideas behind some of the things they're talking about are progressive, but the language they're using is absolutely not. And that can be a weird thing to encounter.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it was progressive in 1916. That motorcycle's
pissed.
Real mad about it. Yeah. Maybe it was more progressive in like 1969 or something, but no longer the best framing these days.
Yeah, for sure. It's not a long book, but it is a dense and hefty book.
Yeah, agreed.
I think that because we're reading it for the first time, and it's the kind of book that I think has continued to be studied for a long time, we are not going to get to everything. But I think there are probably a few things that I imagine stood out to us first and foremost. And for me, at least, and one of the things that like drew me to this book in the first place is the idea that Ursula Le Guin is writing about an entire people whose biology and understanding of sex and gender based on that is completely different than what we are used to. And
yes,
anytime we got to learn more about sex on Gethin, or Winter, as sometimes the planet is called, that is, in this first read or this first experience with it, the thing that was always most interesting to me. Even if sometimes I was surprised by how it was being talked about, that was always the stuff that I was like, oh gosh, I'd like, thank goodness. There was like one chapter that was like entirely about that, and I was like, whew, I get to relax a little bit. Basically, the idea here is that all of the inhabitants, all the human inhabitants, everybody is basically considered human, all the characters, even though they're like different, I guess, branches of human. Or I guess this book just calls them man. We're all man.
Yes. I can't wait to talk about this
specifically
once we get past this.
Yeah. But Generally, it sounds like most planets that are inhabited by humans or mankind have the same kind of human. But for some reason that I don't fully understand, but I think was addressed, Gethin, a.k.a. Winter, has a group of humans who are all, for the most part and for most times in their day-to-day, androgynous and sort of like biologically asexual in like the in the biology term, right? Not as far as attraction mm-hmm. goes, but I guess kind of that too.
Yeah, they said they didn't get horny except for once a month.
Yeah, so for the vast majority of their lives and day-to-day, they are neither man nor woman or any sort of like sex-defined person. Mm-hmm. And then once a month, it sounded like they would experience something called Kemmer, during which they would become a sexual being, and any Gethinian could during that time end up man, I'm putting all this in quotes, man for that period of time, or woman for that period of time. I guess I shouldn't put it in quotes. That's literally how this book treats it. There's not really any lot of in between.
The book treats it through Genli's eyes.
Yes, which is an important point for sure. And a thing to untangle, because we learn everything through Genli. And at first I was like, is this book wildly misogynist? And then I was like, oh, wait, hold on. Sorry. Narrator. The narrator is wildly misogynist. Because the way he describes everything, it's all extreme. It's like as heteronormative as possible
and all super male centric.
Yeah.
Womanly jealousy and all this kind of stuff. It's like, oh my God, Genli, get out of here.
I kept getting, like, in the first couple chapters, just as he was, like, describing the Gethinians, I was like, what is this book? What have I done? What have I chosen? And then I kept reminding myself, like, a woman wrote this book, and, like, women obviously can be misogynist, too. Yeah. But that was, like, kind of the anchor where I was like, why? Like, why? It kept reminding me to ask the question, why? And you're right, obviously, it is because it is being told by this human man who does not know what to do with the society that does not experience sex the way that seemingly every other human society he's encountered does.
Yeah, their understanding of sex and gender are different from what Genli knows. And one thing that, I first started listening to this, and then it had a really cool foreword where it seemed like Ursula K. Le Guin was talking about, did you have this in your book, a foreword by Ursula K. Le Guin?
Yes.
Where it was like, I am writing about a reflection of the time. I am not looking into the future. Like, don't trust me. Authors can be liars and like all this kind of stuff. And so throughout this entire book, I was like, what was happening in 1968? That this book was reflecting. I haven't done that research yet. I have some like ideas, right, about some things because of just my general knowledge of history. But like, what was happening that mm-hmm. this is the reflection of? Because it also, some of it very much felt like a reflection of stuff today. And so I was like, oh my gosh, like all these years have passed. And yet the things that I think this book is exploring, pushing against, critiquing, or like trying to figure out are things that are still, I think, not super far along or not super far past in the like public consciousness for the most part. It was kind of wild. I also started listening to it. And then once it got into the first chapter, I was like, oh, maybe I need to read this with my eyes because what are they saying? Because it starts off like sci-fi, sci-fi, sci-fi. Like
it's one of those.
You are getting words that are not, they're alien words, you know?
Yeah, every place and name is like something you've never seen before.
Yep. Yeah.
And so many terms that like just exist. And like, this is a book that is trusting you to do some of that work. Like it, mm-hmm. it, It is challenging in both its structure and in the fact that it trusts you to use context. Like when you mm-hmm. learn vocabulary in elementary school and your teacher's like, use your context clues to figure out what this word means. Oh boy, does this book require you to do that. Yes. It'll eventually tell you what things mean, but like there were not that many gimmies in this book.
Yeah, I was like, some of them I'm not even still quite sure, because Genly isn't quite sure.
Yes.
About what they mean, because we're learning about all this. Even the chapters that I think are following another character. Oh, we never said we're going to spoil stuff.
Spoil so much stuff.
But even chapters that follow another character, Estevan, it's because Genly fucking read Estevan's diary.
Tell you who the narrator is.
Yes.
That's what I'm saying. It really relies on you to like figure it out. Like, and uh-huh. it's not a mistake. I don't think she made it. This book is like too meticulously crafted for anything mm-hmm. to be a mistake. But there were just some times where I was like, I know I'm going to know who's narrating eventually, but I wish you would have just told me.
You just have someone at the start of every chapter be like, hey, Estevan. Hey, Genly.
Right. Because everything's in first person. Like, there's no, like, it just goes from the end of one chapter being told by Genly to the beginning of another chapter being told by Estevan. And they're both using I because it's both from their perspective.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, though, like, going back to the sex. Like biological sex and gender stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So like originally, because we hear from Genly for the most part in the beginning, and then later on, after some stuff happens, we hear Estevan's voice start coming in through, I think, those journals. We find out eventually later. Because this whole book is written as kind of like a report and a log of the happenings of this envoy, Genly I. And at first I was like, okay, this is like a population that does not fit our understandings of gender or sex. And Genly keeps using man and he.
Yes.
And that is annoying. And then leader Estevan does it too, or at least Estevan through Genly. And so then I was like, is he the standard for humanhood in this like society, even though they don't have gender, but they still have he? And then I was also like, oh, okay, I see what you're doing. Yes, we do default to man as like the default in like society, right? And all this kind of stuff. But it would have been cool potentially to have some characters who pushed back on that idea maybe a little.
So I did look into that specifically because I was curious. And I had a version of the book that had an afterword that touched briefly on some of the things that, like, some of the reactions to this book. And that was certainly one of them. People were like, is it that progressive if you're only using he pronouns for, like, non-specified gendered people or just completely outside of our structure entirely? And I think Le Guin's initial response was like, well, yeah, like it kind of reflects how we use language. And also, I do think, unfortunately, she said at the time, like, they would have been too confusing for people. Mm-hmm. But I do think she continued to write. I know that she continued to write in this world, and other stories that she told on this world used other pronouns. So like there is a story where she defaults to she for anybody as well. So I don't think maybe when she wrote it, I think she was defaulting to what we used to do and a lot of people still do in our language, which is like, if you don't know the gender, say he. I think she was doing that, but I think she took the criticism and said, okay, well that makes sense.
This it's easy
to
fix.
The
she.
Next one will be she. And then it kind of adds this layer to it where it almost retroactively, I think, makes even more sense that if this is all being told through Genly's perspective, that would be his understanding of what a gender neutral pronoun in another language is.
Yeah. It's interesting, I mean, that her reaction was also like, I thought it was intentional to like show people how dumb it is that we're always like, man is the standard type of thing.
I think it works that way. I just am not 100% sure that was what she was doing.
Yeah, because that's how I was reading it. I was like, ah, gosh, we do this. Right. And this is so dumb. Yeah.
I mean, it's fortunate that Genly is such a misogynist because it does work that way fully, right? Like,
without any
context, you can kind of just come to that conclusion anyway, because every single time Genly doesn't like someone, he compares them to his understanding of what a negative depiction of a woman would be, right? Like, it's always a comparison to a woman. It's not actually, it's not even always like a universal negative characteristic plus woman. It's literally just he only compares people he doesn't like to women. Often he says something that is negative because he hates women, but
and it was interesting too, like Genly, the act of sex in this book and Genly's lack of like sex, having sex in this book was also very interesting to me, because he regularly was like talking about how beautiful some of these people were. And I really thought him and Estravan were going to have a little moment in a tent.
Oh my God. Me too. Me too. Because there were a couple, like there were several moments leading up to that before they were, you know, back together, where he would comment on how beautiful somebody was. And he would say like, you know, beautiful for a man or a woman. Like, either way, people would recognize this is a beautiful person. So I thought it was really building up to him sort of seeing beauty in androgyny. And it wasn't. I feel like when we got to that moment, he was sort of like, oh, but I would never.
I'm not. No, no, no.
Oh, no, sorry.
Not me. No. You are beautiful, but no.
But no.
It's like,
it totally felt like that.
Some repressed things, I think, going on for Genly in this.
Yeah, for sure.
Speaking of Estravan, speaking of this kind of book in general, Estravan, because I think we were seeing him, I guess I'll use, because that's what the book uses, through Genly, I liked Estravan, but also didn't trust Estravan. And it was interesting the way that trust and, what was it, Shithgratha, that concept that Genly never fully understood, that had something to do with like humility and pride, kind of maybe who and how Genly trusted in things, and like how misplaced Genly's trust was overall. Like, I thought there were really some interesting ideas about the idea of like nation and Estravan. I really fucking liked Estravan. Estravan, I felt like, had some really interesting, through that character, some really interesting ideas. Like this idea of, if we are patriotic, does that mean we also have to, does being patriotic require us to hate people who are not in our nation? And I was like, damn, go off, Estravan.
Right?
Go off. If you're a traitor, I'm a traitor, because I am down.
Right, because Estravan is like, I'm with you. I really like Estravan. And at the beginning of the book, Estravan is exiled off screen, for lack of a better term, right? Like, we don't see Estravan's exile. We don't see the conversation where it happens. We don't see any of it. We learn when Genly learns that Estravan has been exiled, and we only get the narrative that Genly gets from the people who exiled him, right? So because it was presented in that very specific way, I was immediately suspicious of the exile and was like, I don't trust anything you're saying about Estravan. So by the time they were back in the story, I felt so validated by so many of the things they were doing and saying, because I was like, yes, you are cool. There was fishy business going on. Something was afoot, you know? You weren't a traitor, or if you were, so, like you said, so am I, it was, you know?
Yeah, a good kind of traitor, because that you aren't actually a traitor. Because, like, was it Tybe, the, like, king's cousin who was able to rule for a while the king was pregnant? Tybe, the things that Tybe was saying that we hear about through, I think, I heard this is what's happening, type of thing, was very much stuff that reminded me of like 2016 to 2020. And like the, you know, we need to, we're going to be the best. We need to fear other people, right? Like,
yeah.
I thought that, like I said, the things that were happening back then, still relevant concepts today. And that idea of nationhood, that idea of fearing the other, and how do we escalate the fear amongst a population to get them to believe more in me instead of sharing with each other type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are, I mean, she does set up like these two specific nations that you meet in this book. And it sounds like there are some other mm-hmm. societies on this planet, but the two that you meet are, oh God, I'm going to get their names wrong if I don't read them. Carhide and Orgarain. who I think, like, obviously very intentionally, are presented just as like two very different kinds of nations. So like mm-hmm. Carhide has a monarch, and like is less sort of organized and sort of structured. And then there's Orgarain that doesn't have a monarch and has like a council basically, but is like structured to the point where you're sort of like, oh, you're like messy now because like there's all this stuff happening in the background and like all these sort of like conversations happening under the table. So like it's interesting to have those be the two dynamics because it mm-hmm. ends up presenting these these two nations that are both like making each other and being very mm-hmm. nationalist about their own nations, sort of like on a weird equal playing ground because like things that are good about one are like bad about the other and vice versa, you know? Like, I don't know, it was really interesting. There was neither one of them that I, by the end, was sort of like, oh, I think I side with this one. I just was like kind of the same critical for both of them, but like for different reasons, obviously, but like kind of the same amount.
Yeah. I think by the end I was more team Carhide just because of Orgarain. I feel like Carhide's mess you could see, and Orgarain's mess was like hidden, and they hid it behind a lot of structure. So they're like, let me see your papers. Let me make sure you do this. Let me make sure you do that. And it was like very much structured and like apparently trying to be like, oh, everybody has a job type of thing. But like,
well,
you are also
thing.
Treating some people very differently here,
right.
type of thing.
I think that's why it's sort of like, yeah, I agree with you. Like, I'd rather see the mess, right?
Yeah.
But there were certain things about Orgarain that, like, philosophically, I was like, okay, like, I like that that's a thing that you are saying you do. So I think what's interesting is both of them sort of represent the idea that any system ideally can work, right? And I know it sounds wild to say that, like, a monarchy can work. But the thing with political systems is that they're all flawed because none of them work ideally, right? Like any political system technically can work if everybody is like operating ideally. It's just that nobody does that. So both of these are like perfect examples of how like, okay, they have these values and they have this council and all this sort of stuff. But yes, like all that structure and bureaucracy is like pushing the ideal away and creating all these little pockets for corruption and like and then obviously all the problems and trappings of a monarch happen over here on the other
right
end. But I agree with you, I'd rather see all the mess. It's a lot easier to tackle like a problem you can see.
I feel like I could navigate that maybe a little bit more.
They both fucking throw him in prison though, I'll say that.
One
of those prisons is a lot cushier than the other.
Significantly nicer prison in Carhide.
I mean, if I'm choosing based on where I'm getting thrown in prison, it's definitely team Carhide.
You don't want to be naked in a truck for many days.
No.
And also somebody died in there. And then what if we constantly inject you with drugs?
No.
I mean, some stuff about our prison system in there too, the way we treat folks who are imprisoned.
It wasn't lost on me that they described the beds as a shelf. There's a lot of prisons, those beds are basically just a shelf.
I was not expecting when things took a turn. I mean, they really took a turn. And I don't know what I was expecting to read, but I was not expecting like such intense imprisonment. I wasn't expecting a like journey across desolate, like extreme winter weather and ice. Yeah. I wasn't expecting the scene where Estevan, where they're like walking and it, you like can't see anything. And then Estevan just like disappears. I was like, oh, he's dead. Estevan is dead.
The whole idea of there being so much light that you can't like understand direction anymore is so wild, because usually you only think of that when there's no light, but it makes just as much sense that like, if all you see is the same, if it's just white, if everything's just white, you still have no sense of direction. There's no horizon line. There's nothing, no difference between the sky and the snow. Like there's nothing to relate yourself against. So that was such a wild thing to think about.
Yeah. And then when Estevan is just gone, I was like, oh no, how is there more book? Cause Genly's not making
Genly's fucked. Yeah. It's wild that like halfway through the book, it really turns into like all this imprisonment and journey, and like it's really long and detailed, and like it was still interesting despite that. Like that runs the risk of being like, you know, an odd proportion. But she manages to do weird things with time. Like there are some chapters that take place over the course of like 3 months. And then there are some chapters that are just like, here's a day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Some chapters are written like journal entries. Some are written like, you know, scientific reports. Like it's one of the cool things about the book. And that I actually was sort of like, I found really inspiring, because I was like, ooh, like this is a cool way to structure a book, you know?
Yeah. I do have a question about Estevan, because there was a chapter early on about two brothers. So incest is cool here. Two brothers who I think were in Kemmer together. And
incest is cool here with an asterisk, I want to point out, because there are some caveats.
Until a child is born, and then it's no longer cool.
And never intergenerationally.
And also no parent. Yeah. So siblings or cousins, I guess, are fair game.
Yeah.
Which
I know feels like a weird distinction, but I do think it is an important distinction for her to throw some of that stuff in there.
So early there was this story about these two, as they were called, brothers. And it was about them, I think, like being in relationship with one another. And then one of them had a kid, and then that meant they couldn't be together anymore. And then one of them died by suicide. And then the other one was banished, because having somebody die by suicide is like somehow a reflection of you and the relationship and got you banished from a place. And then later, there is kind of revelations about Estevan. And is Estevan the guy from the early story?
I'm not. Because
he
totally
had brother
honest,
stuff.
Because
I feel like when they did the mind speak, he's like, why do I hear you and my brother's voice?
Oh, that's
my brother's been
my
dead.
Brother's
and
dead.
I was like,
yeah.
And then I was like,
that.
Is that
Holy
the same?
Shit. It could be. I'm not really sure, because there's an, like, I guess I wasn't thinking about it, because it wasn't the only sort of like parable like story that was told in the book. So it didn't even occur to me. Like sometimes the book will just like explain
Here's
something
a Gathenian
via parable
story.
Instead.
Right.
So damn, wow, I hadn't even thought of that. I'm not sure. I'm really not sure.
Me either.
But yeah, I mean, this is a thing that exists in our world too, but like they have really cold and callous views on people who die by suicide in this world. And it creates some really unfortunate and sad scenarios.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
It was also interesting too. So because Genly is not of that world, and always has a penis. This was like a little funny, but a little jarring when he's always called a pervert.
Yes. Yes. See, this is why I found all of their biology so fascinating, because their biology, there is, I mean, I will throw in the caveat that there is definitely some like essentialism going on here, because there's never really much of a separation. There's like a few things you could point to, but that aren't ever really explored, that like potentially buck that a little bit, but it's very essentialist. So like basically in this world, like all of the biological sex defines relationships with each other and the entirety of how society operates. So anybody who like is, for lack of a better term, like stuck in one sex is just like considered a pervert, which yeah. is like, it's really funny. I think it's funny because it's hard to create like an actual analogy for that. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Genli, he's like this human man who's also deeply misogynist. So just having him be referred to as a pervert is very funny.
Yeah. Yeah. When it happened, I think in that like foretelling circle and stuff, I was like, okay, y'all are being weird to this person, and I don't like that. It is not their fault.
Right. Right. I mean, the problem, even though there's not an analogy necessarily for it, there is, Genli does observe that like anybody they call a pervert here or abnormal here is sort of reversed for his right. understanding of his own human society, right? So, like, anybody who is overtly sexual outside of the very specific window is considered a pervert. And it's not that weird in our world, which is Genli's world, for people to label anybody outside of the norm when it comes to sex or sexuality as a pervert simply for existing outside of that norm. So there's like kind of that. But yeah, I was also bummed. Okay, the foretelling thing was really fascinating to me, but that is absolutely what I was referring to at the top when I said like there are some cool ideas here mm-hmm. that are on the verge of, if not explicitly progressive in the idea, but right. all of the language and manifestation of it, not just because it's being told by Genli, but within the society which is being crafted by Le Guin, some of that I was like, we could have done better. So like there are some the foretellers group is made up of several different kinds of people. And when I say kinds of people, I mean some of them are, you know, these like androgynous people who follow the sort of normal cycle of any Gathenian. There's the one, at least the one person who they call the pervert, who is overtly, has an overtly sexual body at all times. And then
it's just in Kemmer constantly.
Yes, in Kemmer constantly, right.
Because I don't know if they were always, I know they did touch the hand of the person, but I don't know if they're always sexual, you know?
Right.
Like, they're just always in Kemmer? I don't know.
That is a better way to put it. In Kemmer means that they have external sex characteristics that don't normally exist, right? Their bodies literally physically change during their Kemmering. Right. So like day to day, most people don't have outward sexual characteristics. They're all androgynous bodies. But during their Kemmering, their bodies physically change and they are either a child bearer or whatever you would call someone who's not, but is still a participant. Not really yeah. sure. But that person, yes, is constantly in Kemmer is a way better way to put it. Because simply being in Kemmer doesn't mean that you are like constantly
humping everything. Right.
Some of the terminology
is weird. Genli
is
always
like,
in Kemmer.
Right. Right. Genli is constantly in Kemmer and is like anti-horny.
Weirdly anti-horny.
But some of the terminology is weird, right? Because like the way that this book uses the word bisexual is like very different than the modern understanding of bisexual. It literally, yeah. I think, truly just
two
means
sexes.
The presence of two sexes.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's some of the language is like,
which that was false on Earth probably anyway. Back then, for sure. But you
the
were talking
foretelling
about the people,
thing, right?
Yeah.
So
there was also a celibate person.
There was a celibate person, right? It sounds like celibacy there works the exact same way, that it is something that people choose. I'm sure there are also mm-hmm. people in this world who never end up being in Kemmer. I feel like that's totally reasonable, if not explicitly stated. But also part of the foretelling group are people who were compared to folks who have schizophrenia. And that's it's the only real way I can put it, because all the other language they use to describe them is like, really pejorative.
Not cool. Yeah.
And that's the only language we get that's grounded in any of our understanding of what these people might be experiencing or what their life is like. And that was a bummer, because the attitude of the members of society toward them was actually super cool, even though all their language sucked. Because Genli is like, well, you're so advanced, couldn't you cure them of what they're experiencing? And the response was so matter-of-fact, like, why would we cure them of something like that? Would you cure a musician for being a genius musician? Like, it was cool, like, that idea, right? That it was a different way of experiencing the world, and it's not hurting people.
Yeah.
It's just unfortunate that, like, the language sucked, and they had to compare it to something specific to our world that, like, probably was not an appropriate, like, comparison for even how they were discussing what was going on. Like, that was a huge bummer to me. I was like, damn, that was, like, a huge, probably the biggest miss, I think, of the book was just that language.
Yeah.
I have to imagine she would have done it differently if she were doing it now.
I would assume. You know, we've learned a lot about mental health in the past. However, 70, oh my gosh, 1969 to 50 years. Math.
Yeah. And she seems very cool. So I think she would do differently.
Yeah, I think so too.
But the foretellers thing in general was fascinating, because it's a real thing that's being experienced in that world. Like, there's not really any ambiguity there.
And I liked the idea of, like, the foretellers. So the foretellers are a group that people come and can ask one question to, and they will do this sort of thing to get an answer. And if you ask a specific question, like, they share a parable, a story about somebody who came and asked a question about what day am I going to die? And they were like, the 16th of the 16th.
Not even.
You're going to die on the 16th.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then
the response was, the 16th of when? The 16th of,
like,
what month?
What?
The 16th of what year?
What year? And they're like,
you've
already got your answer.
I loved that parable, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that person, because then their partner goes and asks, like, hey, when's this person going to, how long are they going to live?
How long will they live? And they got a valuable answer, which is that they will live longer than you. Which is still really valuable information. I mean, it sucks for the second person who asked, because they have no information for themselves. But if the thing that was driving that other person into, like, solitude and paranoia was that the 16th could be any day, they know that as long as their partner is alive, they're safe. But they were so blinded by the paranoia and the ambiguity of the answer that they, like, couldn't see the value in what their partner had done for them.
And yelled at them and killed them.
And killed them. mad. I loved the story. Yeah. Didn't love the outcome.
Exactly. I was like, this could have gone so differently.
Oh, yeah.
But I liked that these foretellers are like, we would never ask us a question. Like,
yes.
Never in a million years would I ever go to foretellers and ask a question. And I liked that. Part of why they were saying this was, like, part of life is accepting the questions are, like, our life. Like, questions are your journey. What's the point of knowing the answer type of thing?
Right. And the answers to the questions that most people will ask are only things that are going to complicate and create problems. Like, when am I going to die? You know?
Right. What is Genli that going to be useful for?
Right. Genli asks a question, basically asks, like, will this world join the Ecumen, which we never actually named, but that confederation is called the Ecumen.
Yeah.
Will they join the Ecumen? And, like, that's specific enough, or I think within the
within
next
5 years.
That was specific enough that the answer he got was just yes. But even still, like, all the variables surrounding that are still a mystery. So, like, is that answer even valuable to you in the way that you thought it would be? Not really. Right. And that was, like, kind of the whole point of what they were saying, which I really loved.
Yeah. What is this answer going to do for you? Like, how is this going to make your life better, or is it just going to make it worse?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting, too, because, like, the value there is then whether or not you can accept that that answer isn't helpful. Because if you can walk away and be like, oh, shit, you know what? Didn't actually get out of that what I thought I was going to get out of that. I'm going to let this experience go. Then, like, you've learned the valuable lesson. Mm-hmm. If you don't do that, then you end up in the parable, the guy in the tower who kills his partner.
Like,
The foretellers, I could have spent so much more time with them, but I'm glad that we got what we got. And I wish that it, you know, all the stuff I said earlier, I wish was different. But as far as just like what they represented and sort of their them being like the religious part of this sci-fi book, was really fascinating to me.
One thing that I really liked and thought was interesting. So there's a lot of things in this book that are so interesting. So one of the points they made in this book is that because everybody can get pregnant, the job of raising children, of like doing, you know, homemaking type stuff, is everybody's job. Like, there's no burden on one particular type of person to have to do the work of like child rearing, of being, in like earth terms, like a woman of the house, right? A wife, a mother. That is literally everybody's job, and everybody understands it, and we understand how important it is and how hard it is, and cool, do what you need to do type of thing.
Love this. I love this so much for a couple of reasons. One, I had a D&D character once that lived within a society of people where anybody could carry children regardless of like their gender. So like seeing this, I was like, hell yeah, it's like the race I created in my D&D campaign.
Hell yeah.
But two, like, I mean, it's just such a good like examination of all the problems that we put onto like child carrying and childbearing and child care. Like, nobody is quote off the hook because they'll never get pregnant.
Right.
In this world, anybody who is sexually active in this world has the potential of carrying a child and birthing a child. So like, nobody gets to just be like, oh, I'm going to go off to work and that's my job, that's my role. Like people do in our real world. Like men do in our real world. It's such a fascinating thing to think about, especially when you think of like just the relationship that people have to sex and how much sex people have and like why that's considered like okay for men and not okay for women based on what role they play in all of that and the risk that exists in all of that. Like, they even address that in here where they basically say like the risk of having a kid is the same for everybody.
We all gotta think about it.
Everybody's gotta consider it.
Yeah.
You can't wipe your hands clean even if you were an active participant.
Nope. You are part of it.
Yep.
And you understand that you're part of it. It's not something it seems like that it didn't seem like a lot of folks did want to, at least in Carhide. I think in the other place, they had a different system. They like had like a communal space where kids went or something. I can't remember exactly.
Both societies had like the idea that community raises children, but how that manifested was like very different in the two countries.
Yes. Yeah. As I was reading this, I was thinking about what would this, if Ursula K. Le Guin were to write this today, like what sorts of things might be different aside from the language? Like, I think, you know, I'm sure she is aware. I don't know. I'm just assuming because we have continued to read some of her books she's cool with trans people. She's aware of the existence of non-binary people. And so I wonder how that would complicate some of the, mm-hmm. or enrich or deepen some of the things that she wrote, like, back in the day. And, like, I don't remember hearing of people in Kemmer who ended up manifesting the same type of, like, sex organs. And so... do you remember right. that happening?
No. I think it was pretty explicit that if you were a vowed pair in Kemmer, one of you would, like, you would both develop different sex organs. I think that was my takeaway.
Yeah. And I'm assuming with alien other, you know, sex organs, there's probably still ways to pleasure if you've got the same parts, you know? So, like, it would be cool to see.
I don't know that they ever refer to those sex organs as sex organs we recognize being humans.
Right.
Like, I don't think they were ever described. Yeah. I think it really was.
We don't know if they have penises and vaginas, and we know they have boobs, I think.
We know,
because I feel like they talked about a chest
at one
enlarging.
Point when other humans arrive at the end of the book, the Estravan describes human women as being more exaggerated versions of Githenians.
It might be Genli, because Estravan is Genli? Dead by the end.
Oh, that's Estravan's right.
Estravan's dead
right.
by the end.
That's right, because Genli's going through the whole thing of being like, oh shit, that's right. I'm seeing humans again for the first time, and
right.
they look so exaggerated. That's right. You're totally right. Genli describes, like, human women as, like, a much more exaggerated version of Githenian people who develop organs that can carry children. So, like, I think what we know is that, like, they get hips to carry children. But, like, I think they have breasts, but they're not as exaggerated, I guess, as human breasts. I don't know.
Could be a
That's
wide
like
variety
all we
there
ever
too.
Really get. Like, I don't, we don't hear anything about the other sex organs involved. We don't actually hear, like, learn anything about even the childbearing sex organs involved. It's more about the child carrying body, or the child carrying body.
Yeah. And, like, we don't need to, but it would be, we could still hear about queer sex of people who have the same types of parts, or, like, different combinations, not that there's just these two. So I feel like if, I don't know, it'd be cool. It was still cool to read, but it'd be cool to see what it would have been like if it were written today, type of thing, how these ideas would have evolved since then.
Yeah. It would be. I would be very curious to see, like, how this would manifest differently. The one thing that I think might be explored more that I think was briefly touched on is, like, some people, and I don't remember exactly how much more it was elaborated on, but it sounded like there were some people who induced their own Kemmer and, like, chose their sex organs, basically. And I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like it was referenced that there were people who, like, purposely made themselves, quote, perverts, like, that they they induced it and kept their bodies that way.
That sounds kind of right. And I feel like there were also people that, or no, maybe this was the forced stuff in the prison that they,
I mean, there
forced,
was definitely
kind
that.
Of like sterilization, kind of forced sterilization in prison.
There was definitely
what an
that
alien
so,
concept, wink wink.
I know, right? Maybe that's what was being referred to at the beginning of the book, and it turns out to just be, like, a horrifying thing. But when I read it at the beginning of the book, or when they reference it early on, I think my initial interpretation was like, oh, that's like, those are actually kind of the queer people here. Like, those are people who are, like, choosing to, like, exist differently in relation to everybody
though,
else.
I mean, those are the people always in Kemmer who are considered
choice,
perverts.
Right? Well, there's
right.
Some people it's involuntary, right? But then there were, I feel like they referenced people who induced it.
Okay. Either way, I feel like they,
unless it turns out that was just, like, the horrifying thing that the O Nation was doing.
Yeah. I don't know.
Remember when I said we were going to be figuring some of this out as we went?
We weren't going to figure some of this out. And that's okay.
Yeah. But if that is a thing that was part of it, I feel like that's something that would get explored more. People who actually, like, are able to say, like, hey, this is actually the body that I feel correct in. And I'm going to, we have the tools to let me live this way. I'm going to do that.
Yeah. There might have been something in there.
I'm gonna headcanon that those people exist and they just weren't part of this story.
Well, I feel like a lot of people exist outside of this story, right? Like, this is a whole world and we didn't even meet all the people in like one town. Never mind, you know. So definitely the people who naturally stay in Kemmer exist. The people who choose to stay in Kemmer exist. There are probably people who choose to stay out of Kemmer all the time. You know, like it all... It all exists.
To me, it all exists.
Yeah, because why not?
Yeah. Yeah. To oppose something is to validate it, right? So if you insist that it doesn't, what are you hiding?
It does. Yep. Damn. Bring out those things, Doug. Bring out those quotes.
There's so much going on. Is there anything else you really want to make sure that we touch on before we... close this chapter of our talking about this book? Because I have a feeling you and I will continue to talk about this book off the podcast, but for the podcast, anything left?
Yeah. Nothing that I can think of other than I just scrolled down on our notes and realized you put in a bunch of other things. And I'm so sorry. I didn't see that before.
That's all right. We touched on a bunch of it anyway.
Is there anything else you...
I guess the only thing that I want to point out that I thought was neat that we haven't touched on at all is the Gathenian understanding of time, which is really focused on basically like mindfulness and living in the present. Every year that they experience is year one, and all time is in relation to the current year being year one, which seems like, to my brain... experiencing time the way that we have defined it, an absolute nightmare. But the idea behind it, I think, is very, very cool. Because it shapes their society and their understanding of what matters in the present, as opposed to focusing on some other fixed point as more significant than the moment you exist in.
Yeah.
I thought that was cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I fully didn't totally understand it. But yes.
I like this book. There are certainly problems with it that I think mostly are chalked up to when it was written more than the person who wrote it. Because I think from the little bit I've seen, Ursula K. Le Guin takes the criticisms and takes them seriously. I hope that the more I dig into that, I find that to be more true than I currently understand it. But I do enjoy this book. It is tough because it's not a breezy book. We were lying when we said that it was. but I ultimately...
thought we were telling the truth this point.
At this point. but I ultimately enjoy it. So it does get a thumbs up for me because I think a lot of the ideas... and a lot of the stuff that it's exploring in the society are really, really cool. It's definitely one of those books that is like maybe more interesting than it is like fun. But it's interesting enough that like when I finished reading it, I was like, am I going to read this book again at some point? You know what I mean? So thumbs up for me.
Yeah, I think I'd give it a thumbs up too. And I agree with all the stuff that you said. It made me want to take an English class again to be able to discuss it. So I was very excited we were talking with each other about it. Because there's still stuff, like, we didn't even talk about, like, the title or that little kind of poem type thing. You know? Like, there's so much in this book that talking with people to help me parse out what's the symbolism? What is the context, right? Like, that would have been... I mean, and it was extremely helpful talking about it with you, but like, I need more to like understand.
you could teach an entire 3-month course on this book. Because there's like, there's so many themes, right? Like you could talk just about the politics of this book. You can talk just about sort of like the structure of sex and gender in this book. You could talk specifically about the storytelling and narrative structure of this book. Like, it's small but mighty, you know?
Yeah.
I would love to take a class on this book.
Me too. And if you're like us, or maybe you did take a class, send us your syllabi and what we should read to understand it.
That would rule, actually.
Yeah, it would be pretty cool. Let us know, right? Thanks. One, thank you for making it this far and for listening to the podcast. If you've read this book, or if you have thoughts about this book, or if you have articles about this book or podcasts or literally anything to help me, I'll say me, process.
Oh, me too.
Please let us know. And you can do that through email at novelgamingpodcast@gmail.com or through Twitter at novelgamingpod. And if you enjoy what we do, you can rate, review, and subscribe to Novel Gaming wherever you listen to your podcasts. And be sure to check out the Glitterjawed Podcast Collective for other cool, queer podcasts for you to listen to. We would all be grateful for it. And we will be back in a couple weeks with another new episode.
Hell yeah. See ya.
Bye.